Hello, friends. Welcome to my bunker. I'm in my shed, which is an office, which is at the moment some sort of battle bunker ready for whatever's coming our way. I hope you're well. I hope that you're sane. I hope that you're safe. So let's keep in touch with each other. Let's keep talking to each other. Do keep sending me emails. Maybe we could even start some sort of group where we can start to swap ideas together. Anyone who's getting through this needs to do it together, right? Okay. Mark 3. This is a key verse or chapter in the Gospel of Mark. In fact, it's so key that a scholar named Ched Myers wrote his commentary on the Gospel of Mark, and he actually called his whole commentary, Binding the Strong Man, after the story that we're about to look at in Mark 3. Can I just pause here and recommend Ched Myers' Binding the Strong Man, a political reading of Mark's story of Jesus. I'll put it in an email to you so you have it. But this is, I'm not even exaggerating, this is the best commentary of any book of the Bible I've ever read. It actually changed my life, and one cannot say that about biblical commentaries very often. In fact, I have never said that about any commentary except this one. I'm not even exaggerating. Really changed the way I was able to read not only Mark, but in fact, all the other Gospels in the New Testament as well. There are other people I'm drawing from, absolutely. I'm not just a slave to Ched Myers here, but boy, is this guy a pillar in the work that I do. And anybody else who's encountered him knows this is true too. He's a Mennonite. He's a working in, I think he's an American guy, I think, but he was, he works amongst Mennonites and the Anabaptist crowd. And he just has written one of the most insightful commentaries of the Gospel of Mark. It's pretty good. Very impressive. Binding the Strong Man. And he's, like, as I say, he uses, in fact, this story of Mark 3, it becomes his, the motif or the mechanism by which he's going to read the rest of Mark. And one of the key things, I mentioned this in a previous episode, but what you get is the story of Jesus is marching around the around the land. He's drawing together people into his new kingdom. And how he gets people is that he essentially breaks the siege of whatever is binding them and brings them out into the open, and then they follow him. So this is an underlying idea of Jesus's people are coming out into the open, out of whatever has held them down, and are joining his movement, his kingdom. And so what, that's gospel, right? The rightful king has come to break the siege. This is the gospel. This is the action of King Jesus. This is what he's doing when he says, come follow me. Faith means be with me, be seen to be with me, be on my side, have allegiance to me. There's a whole lot going on here in Mark, which is about kingdom building, not religion building. And the story here of Jesus binding the strong man and then releasing the goods out into the open is what, how Ched Myers and others have said. This seems to be a central plank in, or a key to understanding the story of Mark. And the idea here from Ched Myers, his language is that he says there's contested areas. There's spheres of influence that Jesus is showing his authority over. And sometimes in the gospel, the sphere of influence is an actual person who he has to show authority over. Sometimes it's an abstract idea, like racism. We're going to see that very shortly when Jesus talks about the woman who's a dog, the throwing crumbs to the dog. Sometimes it's the whole sphere of linking purity to sin, which we saw in the last episode. Sometimes it's the Roman sphere, sometimes it's the temple sphere, sometimes it's families and inherited traditions. sometimes it's nature. Every time Jesus shows authority over nature by walking on water or making food or calming the storm, he's demonstrating his authority over a sphere of influence, and a sphere that has been contested. There are other forces and powers or people that are claiming influence in that sphere. And Jesus identifies the power, then binds it, and then releases the goods and into the open air. And the goods are always people. And they usually end up becoming his followers, or he identifies himself with them in some way. So this is just an idea to keep track of, to notice. And it's happening here. And the great story comes at the beginning of Mark, which helps to interpret the rest of it. Much like when in Mark, Jesus will tell a parable. Mark has Jesus tell one parable. He then explains the parable, which is of the sower. We'll see that soon too, which is of the sower throwing the seeds. And then, so Mark has Jesus tell a parable, and then Jesus immediately interprets the parable for his disciples. And then there's no more interpretations after that. And it's like Mark is front-loading into his book, into his gospel, keys to interpreting the rest of the Jesus story. He doesn't keep going on and on and on explaining every single parable. He just says, this is how you can explain parables. Here's the key to doing it. And likewise, I think this Mark 3 story is front-loaded at the beginning of the gospel. It's a stuff about Jesus and his self-imagination and what it is he thinks he's doing and what he thinks of his followers. And so it's like a way to pattern the rest of the reading of the gospel. So that's the way I approach it, and this is the way I'm drawing from people like Ched Myers. And I will put, this reminds me, I will put some other readings up. I'll email them to you, and or I'll maybe put them on my website, and so that way you can, I'll show my workings, and you can definitely follow along. There's some good people I recommend. Chapter 3, Mark 3. And again, Jesus entered a synagogue. So now we're back in the sphere of synagogue sphere. And there was a man who had a hand that had been withered. And they observed him closely to see if he will heal on the Sabbath, that they might bring an accusation against him. So again, think of all the spheres of power and influence right now. Synagogues, illness, so the actual physical illness, as well as the social meaning of what was in, what people saw when they saw a man who had been withered. They thought he was a sinner. They thought he was impure. They thought he was should be socially ostracized. They are observing him closely to see if he will heal on the Sabbath. The Sabbath is another contested area, which Jesus has just shown his authority over. Mark 3, the Lord, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Mark 2. So now we're just immediately in. Don't let a chapter break fool you here. Chapter breaks. Mark did not write with chapter and verse. Mark just wrote one text. It's only later on that we've inserted our chapters and our verses into these texts. So don't let your imagination be colonized by the invention of the chapter and the verse, which leads to all sorts of weird interpretive issues. This is a continuation. This is within one breath of Mark 2. Mark 2 ends, thus the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. And then immediately following, he goes into the synagogue and they're worried about healing on the Sabbath. Okay? So this is just a continuation of this story. And they're going to try and bring an accusation against Jesus. So he says to the man with the withered hand, stand up in our midst. And he says to them, is it permissible on the Sabbath to do good or to do evil, to save a soul or to kill? But the people were silent. And looking around with anger, mortified at the hardness of their hearts, he says to the man, stretch forth the hand. Similar here to the anger that he showed when the man with the skin diseases comes and says, the temple couldn't clean me or declare me clean. And Jesus says, I'll do it. Now go show yourself to the temple. There's an anger here. There's a passion. Let's just remember that the claim, when Rome killed Jesus, the claim was, here is Jesus, King of the Jews. So it was a political frame over him. And when the Pharisees and the teachers of the law wanted to kill Jesus, the charge against him was, he's threatening the temple. Jesus, and these were charges that stuck. King and temple threatening. Jesus was not a pliant, religious, Jewish guy. Every time he makes a comment about the temple, he's there. It's edged with anger, or it's edged with dissension, or it's edged with putting it back to rights. He's constantly criticizing the temple in word and deed. And even when he heals, he's doing something that should have happened in the temple, and he's doing it on himself. Stretch forth your hand. He stretched it forth, and his hand was restored. And going out, the Pharisees immediately exchanged counsel with the Herodians against him, that they might destroy him. Verse 6. Look at verse 6, everyone. First of all, Pharisees. Pharisees, I remember, they are the group that dealt with Roman occupation, the impurity that was on the land that came through Roman occupation. They dealt with that by keeping to the law, keeping pure, gathering in the synagogue. They had a synagogue law-based Judaism. And they dealt with Rome and the fact of Gentile taint on their land. They dealt with it through scrupulous keeping pure through the law. The Herodians, who were they? They're the followers or the camp associated with King Herod. King Herod is the puppet king, half quasi-Jewish man set up by the Romans to rule over Jews. King Herod is a race traitor. The Herodians are accommodationists. You would maybe even include in this, the Sadducee camp could sometimes be included in this, because Sadducees were a temple-based form. Their imagination was centered around the temple. And so, and it was Herod who built the temple. So there are groups here that are in constant, deep conflict with each other. And the Pharisees and the Herodians hated each other. They saw each other as, the Herodians saw that their compromises with Rome was what was keeping the doors open, which was keeping the society going and preserving heritage. And the Pharisees saw the Herodians as traitors to the race, traitors to the cause. And now, verse 6, they hate Jesus so much that they're joining together. Gives you some sense of where Jesus was on the political spectrum, the triad here. He's not fitting on any line that belongs. He's not a Herodian or a Pharisee. Okay, the other thing to point out. This man with the withered hand in verse 5 has just been restored. This is not in doubt. The Pharisees see it. Nobody is doubting. Nobody is saying Jesus is a con man. The healing did not happen. It's all in their heads. The Pharisees see the healing and immediately plot to kill Jesus. This is the difference between faith and understanding or recognition. The Pharisees do not doubt that the miracle happened. They have witnessed it. And that is the point at which they have the greatest offense. In the presence of the miracle does not force them to become followers of Jesus. The miracle offers a point at which they now have a choice. Are you offended or are you not? Are you going to be seen to be with Jesus and his way, or are you going to go against it? This is the function that miracles serve in the New Testament. They are not knockdown evidence for Jesus' divinity. More often than not, the people who witness a miracle want to kill Jesus immediately afterwards. Mark and the other gospel writers are not embarrassed about miracles. They are not trying to explain them away, but they also are not trying to load the miracles with a burden that the miracles aren't supposed to bear. Miracles are not proof of anything. Miracles are an opportunity, a crisis moment breaking through, in which a human is thrown back onto their own need to make a choice. A crazy thing has happened. Now what are you going to do about it? And if it's just as an aside, it's worth mentioning or pointing out that if Jesus really is the Son of God or the Word of God or God incarnate in any way that Christians say he is, then one of the first things you learn about God through Jesus is that you can say no to him. You can say no to Jesus all the time. If Jesus is God, then God is not a dominating force. He doesn't force you to do anything. In fact, more people who met Jesus were offended by him than believed in him, than followed him. And this is one of the features of the personality of God. And if you remember that the kingdom of heaven or heaven just means where people say yes to God, well, I guess hell or the kingdom of man is where people say no to God. And this is a valid option. And in fact, it's the option that most people take. And it's possible. If it's possible to say yes to God, that means it's possible to say no. And a lot of the Gospels are about people who say no, and then what happens, and how those strands are woven together for good, how Jesus submits to people saying no to him and refuses to bully them or dominate them, and how goodness emerges out of submission to evil without trying to dominate and control it. So, again, there's politics here, guys. There is politics right here in these verses of what power is and what you do with it and what you how followers of Christ handle the power they have or what they do in the presence of it. And a lot of it has to do with domination and control. And even the miracles of Jesus, even the points in which he's most obviously divine, are not moments of being a dominating bully. Verse 7, Jesus withdrew his disciples to the sea, and the oklos, the great multitude, follows from Galilee, as well as from Judea, and from Jerusalem and beyond Jordan, the environs of Tyre and Sidon, a great multitude, hearing what he does, comes to him. So there's lots of different groups here. Won't go into it too much, but I mean, basically, these cities and towns and regions, they're not all the same social class and they're not all the same cultural heritage. So this is a lot of different types of people gathering together. And Jesus tells his disciples that a boat should be standing by so that they would not press in on him. For he healed many so that as many as afflictions fell on him in order to touch him. And the impure spirits, when they gazed on him, fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." But, messianic secret, he gave them many stern instructions that they should not make him known. And then, Mark 3, verse 13, he goes up into the mountain. There is no Sermon on the Mount in Mark. There's one in Matthew, and there's a Sermon on the Plain in Luke. There's no Sermon on the Mount in Mark, but he does go up to a mountain, and it's at that point he summons the 12. And I told you last time how there's more than 12 followers of Jesus, but there are 12 that have been summoned. There's this team that has been chosen. 12, no brainer really. It's the restoration of the 12 tribes of Israel. It's the restoration of Israel. Jesus the Messiah is drawing together a new kingdom, which itself is a restoration of Israel. So he draws 12 people together out of the multitudes that are surrounding him. And he makes the number 12 that they might be with him and he might send them out and to have power to exorcise demons. Remember, exorcising demons was not part of the toolkit of a prophetic man of God. And here it's being invented by Jesus. And power to exorcise demons or to rebuke demons is, again, it's power of control over chaos. It's the power to bring order out of chaos. It's the work of the Holy Spirit that's hovering over the tohu wabohu in Genesis 1. And the demons are agents of chaos, agents of impurity. And remember, to know their name is to have some control over their destiny. So to rebuke or to exorcise a demon is often to be able to speak, to know where they're going. It's to command them. And we're going to have a look at what Jesus does with commanding demons when he's in the herd of pigs. The commanding part of demons will show up. And he made them 12, and he gave the name Peter to Simon at this point. Peter means rock. James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, he gave them the name Sons of Thunder, or could be Sons of Anger. They later on are the ones who are going to want to call down fire on the disbelieving village. So they seem to be Sons of Thunder or Sons of Anger. They are rebuked for that, by the way. This is not an affirmation of their character. This is a change to their character. And then you get a list of some other people, including Simon the Zealot. Verse 18. So remember that you have Matthew was the tax collector, right? Tax collectors raised by Rome to collect money on behalf of Rome over the Jews. So they are also race traitors. And then you have Simon the Zealot. Zealots were a faction, a group of freedom fighter types who dealt with Rome by fighting Rome. But as I said, it's quite hard to fight Rome when they've got all the spears and the shields and helmets with red brushes on their heads. So what you do is you kill other Jews who are seen to collaborate with Rome. That's who you kill, really, if you're a zealot. And it's just worth pointing out, Jesus had a zealot and a tax collector on his team. Zealots killed tax collectors. Tax collectors hired soldiers to protect themselves against zealots. And they're both on Jesus' team, giving you some flavor of the kind of socio-political group that Jesus is gathering around him. And what must it look like when people looked at the Jesus movement? Just imagine that. So much of the stories in the Gospels is people trying to figure out who Jesus is. What's going on? And it's not just that they're worried about his divine identity. They just frankly can't place him. He doesn't belong. He hangs out with tax collectors. He loves them. And yet he also is got zealots on his team. And he's hanging out with Galileans. And the Galileans were the real region hotspot for freedom fighters and brigands who were opposing Rome. And he spoke with a Galilean accent, and yet he was also going to heal Roman soldiers' children and servants. And he heals elite daughters, and he heals poor nobody women with bleeding. He just does not fit in any of these categories. And it's also worth pointing out that Jesus' own team and his own actions is an evidence of enemy love. It's not just that Jesus isn't just loving enemies in theory. The people he's associating with would themselves have caused offense to other groups, right? So when Jesus heals people, like there's certain levels of people, certain people get healed, which the crowd around would have seen them as the enemy, and Jesus heals them anyway. So you got to notice that there's a lot of enemy love just in the way Jesus is actually carrying himself and gathering his people around him. And then you get Judas Iscariot, verse 19, who betrayed him. So it's, again, the beginning of the seeds are being sown here, that the enemies are ranging. The dark clouds are gathering. Now, trying to pace myself here. I've been talking for 23 minutes. We're coming up now to quite an important one. I wonder whether I might even stop here. I feel like tomorrow I'd rather talk about the binding the strong man, or the eternal sin against the Holy Spirit. Well, tell you what, I'll just keep going, but then I'll stop, and then we're working this out as we go along, friends. I'm making this up as we go along. I don't know how long it really takes to talk through this stuff, so bear with me. Let's just go. I'll go, and then in about 4 or 5 minutes I'll stop, and then you can get on with your day, and I will continue the lesson for a different session. Okay, So he comes into a house, and again the crowd assembles so that they are not able to even eat a loaf of bread, or there's no room to move. Can't swing a cat. And his relatives, hearing this, come out to seize him forcibly, for they said, he is out of his mind. Verse 21, Jesus' own family is now. We've just had Judas Iscariot, we've had the Pharisees, we've had the Herodians. Now we've got his own family. You are insane. You are causing shame to our family. It is worth pointing out. I don't think there's a single story in the Gospels in which Jesus is unambiguously pro-blood family. And it's so crazy to me. You get all these conservatives and family value moral evangelicals who are always talking about family values, when time and time again, there's not a single word in the verse in the New Testament where Jesus is unambiguously pro-family values. More often than not, his birth family shows up as a hurdle to get over, or somebody trying to pull him back. Even when he affirms things like marriage between men and a woman, he's doing it to spite the Pharisees. Even when he says things like honor your father and mother, he's doing it as a way to show the Pharisees that they've got their priorities all wrong when it comes to giving tithes but not supporting their own family. So I'm not saying Jesus was anti-family. He's not against it. But there's no time when he just gives your mother, father, and birth children unit of family life his rubber stamp. Even when he's on the cross in the Gospel of John and he looks down and he sees his mother and he says to the beloved disciple, here, you know, take care of my mother. Well, he's just created a blended family. That's all he's done. Jesus is constantly, the family unit is one of the spheres of influence that Jesus is showing his authority over. He releases people from their inherited identity and sense of obligation to the family unit, and he releases people from that. And he prioritizes it and he puts it back in its box. And people say, oh, I want to follow you, but first let me go bury my father and show my family duty. And he says, anyone who let the dead bury their own dead. Anyone who doesn't look like they hate their mother and father can't be part of the kingdom. So he's drawing such a stark contrast between the family unit of the kingdom and the family units you were born into that I think is just worth bearing here. That this is part of the offense that Jesus caused. This is part of why they had to kill him. Because he wasn't just affirming the common sense of the day. If what you said was, everyone love your mom and dad, and everyone obey each other, and uphold traditional family values. If that's what Jesus really was about, nobody would have killed him. Come on, people. Get with it. Right. Rant over. There'll be more of these, don't you worry. So the crowd is here, and his own family want to remove him. He's insane, they say. And then the scribes come down from Jerusalem, and they say to him, he has Beelzebub in him. Beelzebub is the prince of demons, or if you've the lord of the flies. He has the lord of the flies in him, and he exorcises demons by the archon of the demons, by the highest demon around. Jesus is only having this authority because he himself is one. He has Beelzebub in him, and calling them over, he spoke to them in parables. How can the accuser exorcise the accuser? Or the Satan? We already talked about this before. How the Satan or the accuser is a being of, he's some sort of son of God character, angelic or quasi-divine character, who's been given the role and rule of nations. And it's his job. He was the highest in the throne room, and it was his job to rule the nations, and he's done and doing a bad job. Remember, we're talking about authority here. How can this guy have authority over demons? It must be because he has the authority of Satan. And Jesus looks at them and says, how could Satan rebuke himself? And again, kingdom language. If a kingdom is to be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house cannot stand. Remember, Jesus' own family has just said, you are beside yourself, you're insane. Their household is not going to stand. And if the accuser has risen up against himself and has been divided, he cannot stand, but has reached an end. But no one can enter the strong man's household and plunder his goods, unless first he should tie that strong man up, and then he can plunder his household. Verse 27, here we are, right? I'm just going to end with this, and then we'll talk about the other stuff later. But the strong man's household, that a lot of people, if you're going to talk about in modern mythic language, a lot of people are waiting for the Messiah to be like a Braveheart, like a King Arthur, this nationalist folk hero who's going to rise up in the nation's greatest hour of need and is going to sort of gather the weapons and gather the armies and kick out the foreigners and kill everyone and redeem the land. This is what people want. They want a Braveheart. They're expecting a Braveheart. And what does Jesus do here? He basically says, I'm not Braveheart. I'm Robin Hood. I'm going to sneak in. I'm going to steal from the rich and release to the poor. And if you really want to extend the analogy, is Jesus living in the wilderness with a band of merry men, robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. Jesus says, I'm the thief. I'm going to enter the strong man, the Satan figure, the one who has been given authority over the land. I'm going to break into his house, plunder his goods, tie him up, and then plunder his goods. And the word goods here is, or possessions in verse 27, is the next time we're going to see this word is when Jesus cleanses the temple. And the temple officials cannot carry their goods from one end of to the next of the temple. No one can enter the strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he should first tie the strong man up. This is what I'm going to do, says Jesus. I am tying up the rulers of your spheres that you're in, that have locked you down. I am tying them up and I will release the goods out into the open. And the goods are always people. So watch out when you see this happening, that you don't commit the eternally unforgivable sin. That seems like a really good place to stop. You're going to have to wait a whole day before we talk about the eternally unforgivable sin. See you soon.